From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we're going to rebroadcast part two of a conversation about data visualization. It's a relatively new field in the world of computer science that aims to help researchers gain insight into the data they collect. We'll hear again today from University of Utah computer science professor Mariah Meyer for that discussion.
You know, I think also for better or for worse, these scientists I work with, they're in such need of good tools that you could frankly give them the worst, most clunky thing, and they'll use it because they're desperate to get into this data that they've just spent years collecting.
Plus, your summary of the day's top local headlines and more just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. First up, though, this world news from the BBC. And thanks once again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Coming up a little bit later on the program, part two of a rebroadcast conversation about data visualization with University of Utah computer science professor Mariah Meyer. But first up, we have these headlines. A group that has worked to overhaul the system Utah uses to nominate political candidates is gathering a team of lawyers in case new changes to the election system are challenged in court. Count My Vote chairman Rich McKeon tells the Deseret News that his group wants to prepare if there's a legal battle over the compromise legislation they struck with Utah lawmakers. The move comes after a vote by Utah Republican Party delegates last month to support party leaders should they sue to stop the changes. Utah GOP Chairman James Evans has declined to say whether the party will sue, but says they're considering various options, including legislative or legal tactics. The recent changes allow candidates to bypass the caucus and convention nominating system by instead collecting enough signatures to compete in a primary election. A new report says homelessness in Utah fell by 10% overall last year. But it also shows an increase in the number of people in the state who are chronically homeless. The Deseret News reports 150 people in Salt Lake County were added to the list of chronically homeless in the 2014 survey required by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. That's an increase of 8.8%. The chronically homeless include people who have been homeless once within the past year or who have had three episodes of homelessness in 4 years. Housing officials think the increase is due mostly to more accurate record keeping. Despite the increase from a year ago, officials say chronic homelessness has decreased 72% statewide since 2005. A letter on immigration reform, co-signed by leaders from six different Mountain West states, got a boost from prominent Utahns at a Tuesday press conference. The letter is addressed to each U.S. representative from Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, Nevada, New Mexico, and Utah, and it urges the region's congressional members in Washington to work toward passing immigration reform legislation during the current congressional session. For more on the letter and the diverse group of Utah leaders supporting it, we turn to KCPW's Ryan Cunningham.
A group called Americans for Reform has written a brief letter in support of what they describe as meaningful immigration reform legislation in Congress this year, and they've called upon every U.S. representative in the Intermountain states to work towards that goal. The letter's co-signers are diverse in both background and political persuasion, with signatures coming from six different states in areas such as business, law enforcement, religion, and elected office. On Tuesday, many of Utah's co-signers gathered outside the state's Capitol building to voice their support for immigration reform, including Utah Senate President Wayne Niederhauser.
As the states here in the West, many of us have tried to take on immigration but have been preempted by the federal government. And if you don't want us to do it, we call on you.
Senator Niederhauser cited the influence immigrants have on the economy as a reason to pursue clearer immigration policy.
Immigrants started 28% of all new businesses in 2011, despite accounting for just 12.9% of the U.S. population. From local mom-and-pop shops, many of which turn into regional, national, and multinational corporations, these immigrant businesses account for almost $1 trillion of our GDP, $775 billion.
Paul Miro of the conservative think tank Sutherland Institute also spoke in favor of reform.
It's not usually a conservative issue to take on comprehensive immigration reform, but we feel that authentic conservatism actually is well equipped to address comprehensive immigration reform.
Former Senator Jake Garn expressed disbelief that Congress hadn't passed immigration reform since he left Washington 2 decades ago.
I would never have believed that after working on immigration reform way back when I was in the Senate, and I've been gone for more than 20 years, and still it has not been accomplished. I don't even comprehend that, so we need to push even much harder than we have in the past to get Congress to act, to do something about it, and not be standing here another 20 years from now still talking about how it is necessary to do it.
Gene Hill of the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City wanted to remind congressional leaders that this is a human issue for millions of undocumented people in the United States.
They are here, they are contributing to our communities, they're contributing to our culture, and we continue to exploit them for cheap labor. That is something that we as a nation must stop in order to maintain our credibility as a moral nation and a country of justice.
Salt Lake County Sheriff Jim Winder closed the press conference, and he sounded somewhat frustrated by the current legal framework provided by lawmakers.
Oftentimes, law enforcement in this country doesn't know which direction we're going. We're being pushed and pulled by the various interests, and at the end of the day, it is us who takes the brunt of that criticism, because it is us that has to go out there and either arrest, detain, or not arrest and detain. You are placing us in an unfair, untenable position by not coming to some kind of a reasonable accommodation for these millions of human beings that are in our communities.
Despite the bipartisan support shown in this letter for immigration reform, it seems unlikely anything will occur in 2014. Republican leadership in the U.S. House of Representatives have said they will not bring it to a vote in the current legislative session. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
Police have arrested more than 50 people suspected in a drug ring operating in Salt Lake and Utah counties. Unified Police Lieutenant Justin Hoyle says in a statement Tuesday that over the past week, officers have arrested 11 suspected drug dealers and 40 suspected drug customers. Hoyle says police seized 6 pounds of heroin with a street value of about $120,000. They also seized 11 vehicles, $82,000 in cash, and 12 firearms. Detectives from the Unified Police Department in Salt Lake County and the Utah County Major Crimes Task Force worked on the joint investigation. Hoyle says the investigation began several weeks ago. And finally today, after the rousing success of the inaugural Salt Lake Comic-Con last year and Comic-Con's fan experience last month, the pop culture freight train kept on rolling Tuesday with new announcements from the event's organizers coming at a playful press conference. The media event opened with Darth Vader, Boba Fett the Bounty Hunter, and a team of stormtroopers marching into the Leonardo Museum's main lobby. Boba Fett introduced Salt Lake Comic-Con co-founders Dan Farr and Brian Brandenburg as their prisoners.
In our galactic conquest, we've come across two of the most notorious rebel scum we've ever laid eyes on. And now we've brought them here for a few last words before we encase them in carbonite.
Farr and Brandenburg lauded fans for their support in making Salt Lake Comic-Con the largest convention in the state of Utah. They then announced that tickets are on sale now for this September's 3-day convention, and they unveiled their first wave of big stars. This year, convention goers will have a chance to meet Christopher Lloyd, Ernie Hudson from Ghostbusters, Bruce Campbell from the cult classic The Evil Dead, Carrie Elwes of The Princess Bride, John Barrowman of Doctor Who fame, and Sam Witwer of Smallville. Some fans at the press conference were curious about the possibility of a Comic-Con parade. Farr and Brandenburg weren't opposed to the idea.
Question is if there's plans for an outdoor parade, and we've definitely discussed that. If we feel we can get the support for it, we'd love to do it.
Who wants to have a parade?
Yeah! Organizers say more announcements about this year's convention should be expected as the event approaches. Ticket options and more information for Salt Lake Comic-Con can be found at saltlakecomiccon.com. And that does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay tuned. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the program, we're going to re-air part two of a conversation I had in December with University of Utah computer science professor Mariah Meyer. The topic of our conversation was the emerging field of visualization, of which Professor Meyer is a pioneer. Visualization uses complex computer representations to help researchers gain insights into the data that they have collected. Yesterday, we got an overview of the field and heard about some of the design elements involved. Today, we'll look at the immense amount of data that is being collected on a daily basis and explore how research in a variety of disciplines is being affected by Dr. Meyer's work. You know, you talked about the amount of data that we're creating and how much data is out there. And I think that, I wonder if you can put that into context for us. In the past, it seems like by leaps and bounds, we're creating more and more data, and, and it's just out there to be used or not to be used. Are we doing more of that than we have in the past?
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh, yes. Every year, it increases exponentially. And by data, you know, it's sort of, in you can interpret that because, you know, video, for example. I mean, you look at something like YouTube. That might be data for one person. It might not be. It might just be entertainment for someone else. So it is, I think it's pretty hard to get a grasp on just how much data or information is out there. But a couple of benchmarks that we do have is that about 10 years ago, we hit this benchmark of 5 exabytes of data, which we say is roughly equivalent to all the words ever spoken on this planet by humans. So that was a lot. But of course, that was 10 years ago. And since then, it's been rapidly increasing. And today, we're generating over 5 exabytes, probably somewhere closer to 10 exabytes of data a day. So that means that, you know, by noon, we've created the same amount of data in 12 hours that it took all of, you know, mankind to speak, you know, 14,000 years. So
wow.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
That's remarkable. And was that the time of spoken language, 14,000 years?
Well, plus or minus 1 or 2 years, I suppose.
But so this, I mean, this is a lot of data, and much of it is being collected for what? For research? For, you know, or what's being done with this information? Is it being measured?
You know, we can measure everything, but is everything worth measuring?
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's something that a lot of like data-driven fields like biology now are really grappling with, which is great. We have this amazing technology to measure so many things about biological systems. And what we've actually done is we've put ourselves in a situation where now we're drowning in data because we have so much information and we can't make sense of it. So I think there's some people who are starting to step back and question, okay, like, can we be perhaps a little bit more thoughtful about what it is we're measuring, about the data that we're creating, we're generating out there? Because at some point, the signal is going to get lost in the sea of stuff that we're just measuring.
I'm kind of want to dig into that a little bit more and ask if, like, are there specific, it's kind of funny, but are there specific sets of data that people are saying, we really ought not to be looking at this, that we should discard this?
I don't have any examples of specific things like that, but I think there's also this interesting, the quantified self movement right now, where people are measuring, there's people out there who are going nuts about measuring everything about their bodies and their daily life, you know, from their, you know, you get the Zio things to measure your sleep, your brain waves at night. People wear heart rate monitors, they wear sensors, they wear their pedometers, they track like every aspect of their lives.
For themselves or for posterity?
For themselves.
Okay.
Well, I mean, there's even that question, like, yeah. Some people do put their data out there. And it is, like, some people in the medical field are seeing this as a potential gold mine, because oftentimes, you know, people don't come in to see a physician until they're sick.
Right.
And then sometimes that's, you know, they could have been helped so much earlier. So if people are tracking earlier and earlier, people might be able to get this data that was never available before. So that's awesome, right?
Could be useful data. Yeah, at some point in the future.
At some point in the future. But the problem is if someone's recording their heart rate monitor every single day for years, how do you know where to look?
Yeah.
How do you begin to know, like, where the interesting bits are? Because at some point, it's just too much.
Yeah, there's so many questions that come to mind
right
now. But, you know, what is the effect of measuring yourself on yourself, you know, if you keep doing that?
Exactly.
But, you know, I'm wondering if there's anything that you – actually, let's ask this question first. Well, are there challenges that you've – you know, what are the specific challenges that you face in carrying out your work?
I'd say that there are many challenges, and that's what makes it interesting. I think if, you know, sort of starting from kind of the beginning of the process, you know, one challenge is figuring out good problems to work on. I'd say in part because as a visualization person, I'm super lucky in that there's more great problems out there than there are people like me to work on them. So we get to pick and choose. But, you know, how do you find something that's going to be good not only for the collaborator, but also for me as a visualization researcher and wanting to understand more about, you know, the sort of the science behind visualization? I think that this process, this what I call the data counseling process, is just, it's deeply challenging. You know, and I think part of it is that as an engineer, I didn't get training in how to interview people. I didn't get training in how to empathize with them, how to get them to trust me. And so there's all these interesting skills that it turns out other fields, like education psychology, these students take a class in all these things. Wow, isn't that interesting? So there's all sorts of things about doing visualization that were not taught in traditional engineering disciplines. I think design, you know, a lot of my work is heavily influenced by design process. I've never taken a design course, but I've been very fortunate to have design colleagues who I've learned a lot from. So that whole process of translation and how and working with people and getting them to open up and say the things you need to hear is probably one of the hardest things. And then there's this part where, okay, you understand the problem, but now you have this huge space of things you can pull from. And visualization, at least as a computer scientist, visualization is not a creative, I shouldn't say it's not a creative, it's not an artistic process in that you just have this data and you just think, oh, how would it look pretty?
Yeah.
It's about taking a lot of constraints and really trying to sort through those and pick things that are going to meet, you know, a whole bunch of different sorts of challenges that you're working around. And so picking things in an informed way that can sometimes be pretty hard as well when there is no one right answer.
I mean, you say that it's not about this artistic process of how do we make it look pretty, but does making it, you know, sort of streamlined or you know, does the design aspect... Is there a beauty in the clarity you're trying to provide, I guess?
Yeah, so I think what you're asking sort of gets at this really interesting issue of aesthetics, something I find really interesting, but is a topic that I think as an engineer and a computer scientist is sort of something we don't, you know, we work in, you know, quantitative information and blah, 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 and none of this like aesthetic stuff. But people have started to do, in other fields, have done some studies on trying to understand the relationship, say, between aesthetics and usability. So, you know, as a visualization designer, I care a lot about usability, how usable, how intuitive, how easy to use is this tool I create. But is something usable because you like it, or do you like it because it's usable? And people, you know, this notion of liking it, I think, sometimes can be related to the notion of aesthetics. And I think that there's some really interesting, deep questions to ask about that. I think that also gets to notions of design, where there's a lot of basic principles about how you design things about like Gestalt principles. How do you use white space? How do you group? How do you have contrast? What meaning does that give to us as people? That also just naturally, I think, lends to an aesthetic. So, you know, I sort of have this working hypothesis, and we'll see in the next 5 years if this pans out to be true, that if you teach people basic design principles and basic visualization principles, that an aesthetic might naturally emerge because you're making people more aware of every mark that they make and making them thoughtful about why they make that.
And the impact that will have on the ability to glean data from something.
I mean, I'd be kidding myself if I thought that the aesthetics of a tool weren't important to a scientist, because at the end of the day, I want people to use these tools. And the more that it looks and feels like something that makes them happy and warm and fuzzy, the more likely they are to use it, the more likely they are to show it to their colleagues. And so all these things are linked together, but what's hard about it is it's this sort of squishy concept that's hard to put some sort of number or metric around, which is, you know, as an engineer, which is, you know, sort of how we make decisions.
I'm wondering about the practicality for this in the field of education, and if this is something that you pay attention to, is as much as it can be a learning tool for the researcher himself or herself involved in figuring out what it is that they... the data that they have, can maybe some of the tools you've helped create be applicable? I'm sure they can be in the field of education.
Definitely. And there's certainly there's people not just in visualization, but also in fields like cognitive psychology that actually study how are visual representations used or how can visual representations impact students' understanding of complex topics. I had a colleague back when I was in Boston who did this project called Picturing to Learn, where they basically worked with some freshman intro university level physics classes and chemistry classes and had students draw different kinds of diagrams and whatever they wanted to draw. How would you represent this concept, like Browning motion or these sorts of, you know, physical concepts? And then they would look at all these diagrams and see the broad range. Some people would do these very metaphorical, like they would have like little cartoons. Mm-hmm. Other people would do this very sort of scientific diagram kinds of things. And so they were really trying to study, based upon how people were drawing and the way that they were using visuals, how did that impact their understanding of whether or not they actually got this concept? So there's people out there who are studying those sorts of things. And I think it's really interesting because we are inherently visual, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that makes me come to the question of whether or not you take into account the end user. I mean, obviously you do, but if your end user is this particular biologist who is, you know, maybe visualizes things in this way versus that particular biologist who visualizes things in a more whatever scientific way or you know, boxy way. Is that something you think about, or are you thinking more about the sort of broad? I mean, I'm just imagining if you're designing a tool to help X biologist, you want to make it the most usable for that biologist.
Yeah, oftentimes the project I work on, we're working with, you know, one, two, six people at a time, and we do that very intentionally. But there's still this question of, well, does that generalize? You know, if you spend a year working on this thing for six people, who cares? And I think there's this notion of visual conventions, at least in the projects I've worked on, that the scientists tend to rely heavily on visual conventions from their field. And so I've often, it's more about overcoming or convincing people about why a change to a visual convention might be a good thing from a sort of perceptual perspective than it is about the individual differences between scientists. I think also, for better or for worse, these scientists I work with, they're in such need of good tools that you could frankly give them the worst, most clunky thing, and they'll use it because they're desperate to get into this data that they've just spent years collecting. Wow. So I found oftentimes it's pretty easy to get people to adopt things, especially if you give them something that's better than what they have, and that's usually pretty straightforward to do.
Well, I guess they're scientists. I was going to say, what about controls on the collection of the data itself? You don't have anything to do with that because you're taking the data and finding a way to visualize it.
Right, exactly. Okay. Yeah. Thank goodness, too, because, you know, I talk to these biologists and, you know, they spend years growing stuff and then it dies and then they have to grow it again and it sounds horrible. And, yeah, I'm like, awesome. I just come in at the end and they have the data and it's cleaned up and... Like wonderful.
It's a
privileged position.
It sounds like it. You know, you spoke to this a little bit earlier, and this will be my last question. But you mentioned earlier that you wrote for the Chicago Tribune as a science writer. I'm wondering how you got into the field of visualization, how you got into this in general. Was that really the spark, or was there a longer sort of evolution into this?
Yeah, I think it started a little earlier in that. I think my passion just growing up as a kid was always science and math. And so my undergrad degree was actually in astronomy, because astronomy was just a more interesting way to study math and physics. But at some point before I finished my undergrad degree, I started to realize that I enjoy making things more than I enjoy studying them. And so that's when I started exploring computer science, and it really connected. And it was then at some point when I made this leap and recognized that there's this thing called visualization, which is these graphical representations of data, that it was like this aha moment of like, wow, this is a way to do the making and the engineering that I enjoy, but still be involved with the scientific process. And that was kind of the thing that made me really, really excited about visualization.
Well, and it's been helpful to, you know, to researchers, and seems like, you know, there's a big horizon ahead for you to work with. So it's fascinating stuff. Dr. Meyer, thanks for coming in and having this conversation with us today.
Thank you so much.
That was University of Utah computer scientist Mariah Meyer talking about her work in the relatively new field of visualization. You can find this discussion and all of the interviews we feature on the program at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this evening. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Ryan Cunningham and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, we're taking a look at what constitutes an act of civil disobedience, using the ongoing debate over public lands as a framework for that discussion. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.